The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, Israel thwarts an unprecedented attack from Iran. We'll hear from former Ambassador Michael Oren.
And we have to move from reconciliation to confrontation.
The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, responds.
The president has turned his back since October 7th on Israel.
We'll look at President Biden's ineffectual message to Israel's adversary.
Don't.
Larry O'Connor.
Apparently, don't is really his way of saying, we'll probably survive if you try it, but you better not do it again.
And Cliff May on what is sorely lacking in the Biden administration.
We certainly don't have in the current administration a sense of will.
We've got all this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on X at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Town Hall is part of the Salem Podcast Network. We're going to begin and end today with Israel and the national security threats we are seeing escalate so quickly on the world stage. The latest attack, of course, was Iran's direct assault on Israel last Saturday. 170 drones, 120 ballistic missiles, and some 30 cruise missiles, all directed at the state of Israel. We'll start with my conversation with Dr. Michael Oren, formerly the Israeli ambassador to the United States. I do not understand the wilderness of mirrors that we're in. I have a column at Fox that says it's now or never time for Israel. What is going on in your view?
I'm going to give you the four words I hate giving most, which is damned if I know. Really, damned if I know. You don't hear that often from me, right? And it is very confusing. And I could see various deals that could be cut. You know, the United States could say to Netanyahu, okay, do not strike back at Iran less now, at least not in like some very provocative, flammable way, and we'll make it up to you. And how could the United States make it up to us? It could make it up to us in terms of Gazan currency. It can make it up to us in terms of strategic capabilities.
All right, Dr. Oren, we're heading up to Passover. May you have a blessed one. I hope your family is together with that.
Thank you.
People want predictions. And I know they always want predictions. Mine aren't worth anything because I don't know anything. You know everybody. What do you think is going to happen here?
I'm optimistic by nature, and I think that Israel can reach a new understanding with our neighbors. I think that peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia is possible if the Israeli government can throw a little bit of flexibility. But the key to it all is in the White House. And what do I mean? You know, starting in January 2009, the first week in office, Barack Obama turned to Iran and said, "Let's reconcile." And that has been the policy of the Democratic Party pretty much uninterruptedly since then for 15 years. If now there's somebody in the White House has the guts to stand up and say, listen, this failed, this didn't work. And we have to move from reconciliation to confrontation. Then the United States will find that it will regain its great power status in the Middle East. It'll have many countries that'll rally to its side. And we will stick together, and we will overcome Hamas, we'll overcome Hezbollah, we'll overcome Iran with that type of front. And that's my vision for the post-Passover season. Again, the Jewish people rescued from bondage, and this time bondage to horrible terrorist groups, to terrorism, and achieving freedom, true freedom, freedom from fear in our ancient homeland.
But let's close this way, Dr. Oren. If Israel does nothing, what do those hundreds of thousands of young men and women who went into Gaza and the survivors of the 10/7 massacre and the despondent, depressed, and I gather a lot of them have taken their own lives, who have survived this horror, what do they think of this government if it does nothing after Saturday night and it doesn't go into Rafah and it doesn't invade Hezbollah? Do they give up on elected officials?
Again, no. It's very different. Remember, I think I said before that in the year before October 7th, during the great struggles over the judicial reform, the army was politicized. Units of the military, particularly commando units, the pilots said they wouldn't report for reserve duty. So the army was politicized. That genie did get out of the bottle. Now that it's out of the bottle, the army has a say. And it's not necessarily the pilots and the commandos. It's the grunts, it's the infantry, it's the tank and armored units and artillery. People come from development neighborhoods. By the way, half of their officers wear a kippah. They're religious. And they're going to say just what you said. What did we fight for? What did we die for? Why do we watch our friends bleed? The statistics are coming out now about the numbers of Israeli soldiers who are wounded and grievously wounded, thousands. And they're going to say to the government, no, you cannot cut a deal right now. You can't run. We have to see this through, or else all of our sacrifices have been for naught.
Last question. I have seen Naftali Bennett everywhere. It seems to me you told me that everyone gets to leave Israeli politics once, like Bennett did, and then they get to come back. Is that what is going on here, the preparation for the return of a younger, more robust version of a Likud leader?
Yep, absolutely.
Will it work?
Well, he's got some challenges. The right wing of Israel feel betrayed by him. He ran as a right winger and ended up acting as sort of a center left leader. So he's going to have to sort of get back into at least some of those good graces. It won't be entirely possible. But you know, the question is, who does he take votes from? And right now, the way he's poised, I think he would take votes from Benny Gantz. He'd take votes from Yair Lapid, but he wouldn't take votes from Netanyahu or from the Likud. He has to get to a point where he can take votes from both sides.
The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has been clear and unequivocal in his support of Israel. He addressed the dangerous lack of support for Israel we've seen from Democrats in general and the Biden administration specifically with Tony Perkins on their new podcast with the Salem Podcast Network, this week on The Hill.
This is the greatest threat to Israel since their founding almost 76 years ago. Yeah. They realize it, the global community turning against them. They're looking to America for support. And what do they find? They have Chuck Schumer saying that they need to dissolve their government in the middle of a war. Mm. You've been talking to the prime minister.
I have. It's been deeply concerning to him, as it is to all of us. It's almost unbelievable that the president has turned his back since October 7th on Israel. They're leaning into the pro-Hamas, you know, pro-protester branch of their party, that is, if they're fearful of that wing of the party, and it's a rising number of young progressives who are screaming that Israel is the enemy somehow in this atrocity on October 7th. Chuck Schumer tries to intervene in their elections. You had 50 House Democrats just a few days ago sent a letter saying that we should no longer have arms transfers to Israel so they can defend their very existence.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Just in the last 48 hours, you had protesters in Michigan chanting death to America, right. Death to Israel, and the member of Congress who serves that district won't even address it, Rashida Tlaib. So this is an alarming thing. It's a dangerous thing. The reason we stand with Israel, for us, it's a matter of faith, but it's also a matter of geopolitical stability. They're the only democracy in the Middle East.
They bring stability to the Middle East. Right. If they're not there, we've got a lot of problems.
Incredibly so. And all the enemy nations around them are encamped and watching them, and many of them have vowed, Iran, of course, being the greatest adversary, to wipe them off the face of the earth.
Hamas is not the greatest threat.
No, that's a proxy for Iran, as is Hezbollah in the north. It's a dangerous situation.
But in that neighborhood in which they live, tough neighborhood, you cannot fight to a draw. You have to fight to win. And the prime minister has said that. He understands that. But apparently the Biden administration does not.
Yes. You and I have been to Israel many times. The last time I was there, the prime minister and his cabinet met with many, many members of Congress. And they said, we want to remind you all that the reason that Israel can stand is because they know that our brother America, the big brother, as it were, is standing behind them, looking over their shoulder. If the world ever sees that we lack that resolve, they will come with all guns blazing, literally so, against Israel. It's a dangerous, dangerous situation right now. We cannot show a lack of resolve.
The president's message to Iran before this unprecedented attack was one word.
Don't.
They weren't listening. Here's Larry O'Connor in his podcast with townhall.com.
Yesterday in the White House press briefing room, it was John Kirby's job as the spokesman for the National Security Council to try to defend the Biden administration's feckless ineptitude in the Middle East and how they're main message coming out of Iran's act of war against our ally Israel is to just thump our chest and say, Israel better not retaliate. Peter Doocy asked Mr. Kirby a very simple question about the Biden administration's policy toward Iran.
John, has President Biden considered maybe beefing up the public Iran posture to be more than just one word?
You're referring to don't.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about.
And they did it.
Yeah, let's talk about don't for a minute. If you're forgetting exactly what Biden's policy was, here he was just 2 days before Iran's act of war against Israel, where he was asked once again, what's your message to Iran?
What's your message to Iran in this moment?
Don't.
The message to Iran was don't. And of course, Iran did. This is all he's been doing for the last year or so when asked about Iran and their posture toward Israel. Don't clearly isn't working. But here's John Kirby having to polish the turd, as it were, and try to explain to Peter Doocy, his viewers, and really all of the American people about how Biden is really getting the job done with that whole don't thing, even though, of course, Iran did.
You can talk about the don't word all you want, but let's talk about what did happen. And what did happen was Iran utterly failed. And if I'm sitting in Tehran right now, I'm betting that President Biden takes it pretty seriously when he says don't escalate. He's going to act to make sure that you can't. And they didn't. Yes, they fired an unprecedented amount of munitions. But how much of a success did they have, Peter? None. Zero. Very little infrastructure. It was an embarrassing failure for the Supreme Leader for the IRGC.
Here's the thing. When Joe Biden says don't, apparently what that means is don't worry about firing all your missiles at Israel because they've got defense systems in place that will actually intercept all of those missiles and it's not going to cause any damage. Apparently, don't is really his way of saying we'll probably survive if you try it, but you better not do it again. Or else you'll really be embarrassed. A quick reminder, though, about this whole don't policy. It's not just Biden. It's the entire administration. Their entire foreign policy in preventing Iran from doing exactly what they did has been don't.
What is your message to Hezbollah and its backer, Iran?
Don't.
What's the message to Iran?
Don't.
It was very important to send a very clear message to anyone who might seek to take advantage of the conflict in Gaza to threaten our personnel here or anywhere else in the region. Don't do it.
They did it. I suspect that the reason they came up with this whole don't thing is because it's all Joe Biden can memorize and remember without a big cue card to read off of. Hey, if they ask you about Iran, just say don't.
Okay.
Coming up, what is lacking from Team Biden?
We certainly don't have, in the current administration, a sense of will.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
This is Dennis Prager, and now a truly exciting new benefit. My monthly online video get-together for Pragertopia Plus members only. For an hour each month, get an exclusive chance to ask me anything. I'll be answering your questions. I've never done this. Submit your questions for me at Pragertopia.com. This is our chance to connect like never before. Go to Pragertopia.com or click the banner at DennisPrager.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Deterrence. That is what we have lost. Our lack of deterrence explains the escalation we've seen from Iran in recent days. Our lack of deterrence is also behind Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Let's turn now to Cliff May of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a guest on my program. This is not a surprise that we are where we are. What do we do next?
Look, right now, the U.S. needs to have deterrence, and we do not have deterrence. Deterrence means, first of all, that you have a capability that your enemies see as overwhelming, and that you have the will to use that capability, and so they don't want to challenge you. And I should say deterrence comes in two forms. There's deterrence by denial and deterrence by punishment. Deterrence by denial is what the Israelis did. They said, you can't get those missiles to hit their targets. All right, you're not going to be allowed. But then your enemy says, okay, well, we'll try again, see what we can do. Deterrence by punishment says, if you hurt us, we will make you scream. You do not want to hurt us. There is nothing more important for the U.S. as a whole right now, I think, than to reestablish deterrence with its enemies, which we don't have. We don't have them, and we certainly don't have in the current administration a sense of will, a sense of we can hurt you and are willing to hurt you. We did deterrence failed as far as Putin in Russia. Deterrence has failed certainly with Iran. It's not enough to say don't. They have to fear what you say don't. But that means something else, I would argue, and that's recognizing that we're in a Cold War. That Cold War is being led by the strongest, richest, most powerful communist regime ever in history. And it has as its junior partners Vladimir Putin in Moscow, Ali Khamenei in Tehran. It also has North Korea. It also has Cuba. It also has Venezuela. If such a Cold War is taking place and it's more challenging than the last Cold War, well, we have to be on a Cold War footing. And we're by no means. The military is being cut. The Navy is being cut. We're spending trillions of dollars on a transition to green energy, which is not so green. And we're spending not nearly enough or doing enough militarily in order to deter our enemies or to win a Cold War or even keep the Cold War from getting hot. How do you keep a Cold War from getting hot? By making your enemies and adversaries fear going to war with you. And that's not the situation we're in. If we can get back to our Reagan policy, that would make a lot of sense in this world.
Well, Trump began to do that when he took out and ordered Soleimani killed. That was the beginning of a rebuild of deterrence versus Iran. I am just curious, do you think Trump had restored deterrence? Do you think Hamas would have attacked or Iran would have attacked Israel if Trump had been president?
Look, I think it's always hard to do hypotheticals, but I think there's a real possibility that he would have said when he said don't, people would have been frightened that he would do it. If nothing else, he was unpredictable.
Yes.
A lot depends on who's advising him. I think, look, Mike Pompeo, I think, has a very Reagan-esque view of American foreign policy. I think the same of H.R. McMaster. I don't think that of Tony Blinken. I don't think that of Jake Sullivan right now. And I think the other thing, you know, one thing that should have become clear, I don't know if it has, from the attacks over the weekend is that Iran has been at war, not Iran, really, the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the Iranian people. This regime has been at war with Israel and with America for 45 years. Just before I came to the Times in 1979, I was a young reporter in Iran covering the revolution. And the important thing that I did take away, that I did understand, a lot of my compatriots didn't, is this was not an Iranian revolution. It was an Islamic revolution. This was not about the Shah and how cruel it was. It was rather that the supreme leader, Ruhollah Khomeini, wanted to establish a new Islamic empire because the Ottoman Empire had failed after the First World War. They didn't call it a caliphate. They called it an imamate because they're Shia. But that's what this was about. This was about a new Islamic empire rising and challenging and bringing down the West, the Judeo-Christian West. That's what that revolution was about. People still don't understand that. And it's what it's still about. It's still, when they say death to Israel and death to America, that's what they mean.
You know, the person who did understand, you were in Iran, which may have been the best seat. I had the second best seat in the world for the Iranian Revolution because it was the office of former President Nixon at the Elba of America in San Clemente. And we were working on the book, The Real War, and we'd have the TV on and we'd look up and we'd see the mobs marching. He would shake his head and said, they have no idea what is coming. That is one of two pillars in the Middle East, the other being Saudi Arabia. We saw him about Muslim countries, not Israel. And he knew what would happen. It was predictable. What wasn't predictable is the foreign minister of Iran just threatened Israel that they will respond within seconds if Israel strikes Iran. What that does, I think, Cliff, is push Israel towards having to strike the homeland of Iran. Otherwise, they will have changed the equation. Do you agree with me on that assessment?
Yeah, I think the Israelis can and should act strategically. And by that, I mean, I'm sure President Biden is saying we're going to do all kinds of things diplomatically and take a breath and see. For example, the U.S. could snap back sanctions. The U.S. has the power to do that, should have done that a long time ago. So you're not funding both the missiles coming at Israel and the F-15s shooting down those missiles. which is what we're doing in both that war and the Russia-Ukraine war. We're funding both sides. It's not a very good idea. So see what Biden does diplomatically, see what he does in terms of new sanctions and to squeeze the economy. Revenge or escalation can be a dish eaten cold, after all. And then the Israelis also have to think, we would like to restore deterrence. That's important. Most important thing to do, we have to think how to do this, is not let this regime have nuclear weapons, because if those missiles that had been coming in over the weekend had a nuclear warhead, that would have been a much more serious situation. It only takes, as Ahmadinejad, former president of Islamic Republic, said, it only takes one atomic bomb to wipe out Israel.
The clarity window is closing. What I mean by that is, immediately after the attack on Israel, the clarity window was wide open and everyone saw what happened. Every day anyone delays, the clarity window closes. We saw that after 10/7. If they don't hit the Iranian nuclear sites today, I can't imagine under what circumstances we'll ever hit them. Can you? I mean, they're right up to the edge. They're in the breakout mode. If we don't do it now, or if Israel doesn't do it now, we'll never do it.
First of all, the U.S. should do it. This is an international responsibility. The U.S. is the leader of the free world. This is a threat to the free world. That should be done by the U.S., with the Israelis perhaps helping no more. I don't see Biden doing that. From an Israeli point of view, yes, they should do that. But there is a question, you and I don't have the answer to it, of capabilities. Can the Israelis destroy or even set back the nuclear program for 3 to 5 years? Do they have the capabilities in place at this moment? There are difficulties with if they're going to do it via bombers, if they're going to do it, there's a lot of airspace questions. If they're going to do it with submarines, they only have so many. You have to think they're considering the various capabilities they have. They don't want to try it and fail, that's for sure. I would love to see them do something really creative. I once had a very high Israeli official tell me, in this and other cases, we were speaking this, he said, Cliff, if we do something and you say, yeah, that's what I expected them to do, then in a sense we failed. What has to happen is we do something and you and people like you say, oh, I never thought they would do that.
Does Israel have ballistic missiles that can reach Iran?
I believe they do, but reaching Iran doesn't mean they can hit they don't have bunker busters. How deep they can go. You don't want to just hit the top and have 100 feet of concrete or rock and stone between the facility and where the explosives land.
Coming up.
I'm sorry. There are those who want bloodshed. That's what terrorists are all about.
More with Cliff May when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If we have, and Israel has as well, lost the power of deterrence, we've lost it in large part as a result of the naive and foolhardy embrace of a policy of appeasement of our known enemies and the very clear enemies of our allies. Appeasement just does not work. But it sure has been seductive to Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan. Let's pick up on more of my conversation with Cliff May. But let's talk about Lebanon for a moment. I had an Israeli veteran of their forces call in, and I asked him, if Israel goes into Lebanon as part of a comprehensive set of responses, and I mean goes in like they did in 1982 without the massacre, like they did the second time, the second Lebanon war, and they clear everything out, he thought more than double the number of casualties for the IDF in Lebanon as in Gaza. Can Israel absorb that? Do you think the coalition government would hold together through that kind of a war?
I think that the Israelis, on a consensus basis, realize that the threat from Lebanon will have to be addressed. Part of what they're trying to do now, this gets back to what we're talking about, is sequence. What do they need to finish up in Gaza? How soon can they do it? How hard is that going to be with Biden, who as you know, has not been good on this. When do they want to do Lebanon, and what do they need to do about Iran, which is the head of the octopus with all its tentacles? Do I think that the Israeli has a military large enough and powerful enough to be fighting in Gaza, fighting in Lebanon, and fighting Iran at the same time? I think that's stretching it a lot. I think they need to, and I think they will, strategize, sequence, consider the various range of threats and put them in a hierarchy and deal with them that way. We can think it through, but probably I would hope not as well as they think it through in their war cabinet.
There are serious people about national security. You have a bunch of them at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Then there's Club Appeasement, the model UN national security team that we've got over at the White House. And I think with David Cameron and Rishi Sunak, who think the world can be talked into coexisting. Where does the worldview of never, never escalate come from? I mean, how does that even develop? Wendy Sherman is like their poster child. She did the 1994 agreement with Korea. She did the JCPOA. She's back at the Blinken State Department. Now she's criticizing Israel from the outside. Where does that worldview come from? It's untethered to anything.
This gets back to the very beginning of FDD, when the week before 9/11, there I am talking to Jean Kirkpatrick. You know who she was. I hope your viewers and listeners, right? And Jack Kemp. And they said, America is taking a holiday from history. We're taking a peace dividend prematurely. And they were thinking of what we came to call jihadists, those who had attacked us in New York City in 1993, attacked us in Lebanon in 1983, attacked us at Khobar Towers in 96, blew up two of our embassies in 98, attacked the USS Cole in 2000. Here's the one difference. Back then, I think all of us thought, yeah, we have a real threat from terrorists, from jihadists, from the segment of the Islamic world. But China is going to be a good stakeholder in the international system. Remember in 2001, Clinton brought them into the World Trade Organization. We're going to help make them rich. When they get rich, they'll get liberal and moderate and they'll like us. That's going to work out just fine. Russia, Putin will be okay. Surely the Soviet Union collapsed. The Berlin Wall fell. So back then when the FDD formed just after the attacks of 9/11, we thought we had a jihadist threat, but no other. Now today, the international threat matrix is much more complex and worse because, oddly enough, the jihadists are in league with the strongest communist nation in the world and with Russia, which is neo-imperialist. Putin is trying to restore the great empire. He sees himself as a latter-day czar. They're all trying to bring down what they sometimes call the U.S.-led world order, the idea of international law. The U.N. has become a cesspool. It was supposed to uphold all of this. And we're not facing any of those facts. And we need to deal with this, I think, holistically. Look at the situation. Look at the world as it is and the world as we wish it to be secure for Americans and for other free countries, for our allies.
But Cliff, where does that other worldview come from?
I mean, it's certainly the Chamberlain view. If you've always had this view, it's a very seductive view that our enemies, and you saw it, by the way, in Rishi Sunak's most recent statement, which was supportive of Israel, but also nobody wants bloodshed. I'm sorry. There are those who want bloodshed. That's what terrorists are all about. The Islamic Republic wants bloodshed. Russia wants bloodshed. Plenty of people want bloodshed. We have this view. You know, everybody wants to compromise. Everybody thinks peace is better. Everybody wants a good 401k and a health care plan. Ideology is not to be taken seriously, whether it's communist ideology or whether it's jihadist ideology. That's partly a lack of imagination on our part. We don't think about people being different from us, and some absolutely are. So we think we'll enrich them. We'll make them offers. We'll give them a half a loaf. Remember Obama, his strategy in the Middle East was sort of, I used to call it the Mr. Rogers strategy. Everybody's going to share the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Everybody. Yeah, that's fine. You know, okay, we'll just share the neighborhood.
It doesn't work. Coming up, Iran's war on Israel.
They are pressuring Israel on five fronts.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
John Solomon provides exclusive reporting and newsmaker interviews on John Solomon Reports on the Salem Podcast Network.
We broke this story because we got the documents early. They put out this new information, and it affirms our reporting that this Democrat donor gave about $5 million or more in assistance to Hunter Biden, basically paid off his bills.
Subscribe to John Solomon Reports today on Apple, Spotify, Google, Rumble, or at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If the U.S. lost its power to deter Iran, it's also clear that Israel has lost its own deterrence power against both Iran proper and the proxy groups of Iran surrounding the state of Israel. But what does Israel do now? What can they do? That is, what are their military capabilities? We'll turn now to retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, also with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He was my guest earlier this week. In deterrence theory, you can't respond to 330 missiles with anything significantly less, or you are actually saying it's okay to hit us with 330, this is all we'll do. And second part of that question, if we don't hit the nuclear, we, Israel, don't hit the nuclear sites now, will they ever hit the nuclear sites? What's the message there?
So I want to break that up into two thoughts. Your first thought about the size of the strike. It's not the size of the strike, it's the effect, right? So it doesn't have to be 330 missiles. In fact, you know, the reason, you know, 170 Shaheeds add up to about five Tomahawks, right? In terms of likelihood of getting through and doing damage. So what I would say was I could take 10 Israeli land attack missiles properly employed by an F-35 and do enough damage, I believe, to say that was the response to 330. Now, look, there'd be a lot of damage in Israel, either, as I said, a lot of dead IRGC leaders, a lot of oil refinery capacity taken offline. Now, if I wanted to take out their nuclear plant and nuclear program and get to that, that is a good question. I think the Israelis believe they can still do it. I think the United States is not 100% sure whether Israel can do it, but we're 100% sure we could do it if we had to. And we've always kind of hoped that this was a joint decision because the result will involve both our forces afterwards. If they do that, I think we're in a broad scale conflict in the Middle East. And look, I wouldn't put the blame for that on Israel. They have been pushed into a corner by Iran that has taken the money it's gotten back from the administration over the last few years, funded Hezbollah, Hamas, proxy IRGC proxy groups in Syria and Iraq and the Houthis and their own missile and nuclear weapons development. So they are pressuring Israel on five fronts. And so at some point, Israel may decide that they have to go right at the singular cause of their problem, which is the Iranian regime.
If Israel doesn't strike now, when would they strike? I mean, what excuse would they ever have? Because we have a clarity window open. Clarity windows opened after 10-7 and Saturday night. And the clarity window closes very quickly, doesn't it?
You know, I agree. In terms of a military strike, yes. The kind of large-scale military strike, that window's open. Now, there is a unique aspect to Israel where following Munich, following other like attacks on them, they have they've served their retaliation or their revenge cold. I think it took them almost 10 years to kill all the people involved with the Munich massacre in the 1972 Olympics. So they could go around and settle scores. In terms of the strike involving F-35s, maybe Jerichos, but probably mostly the F-35 strike aircraft, I think that has to go down in the next week. You know, they can, for moonlight purposes, other things, there's some adjustments. You know, you you give yourself a, you know, a week or 2 weeks so that you maximize your military operational efficiency. But, you know, they're going to be criticized by a certain group of people no matter what. But in terms of the kind of responsible leaders in Europe and the United States and Northern Asia that kind of look at these issues, that window of clarity is open, I think, for, you know, 7 to 10 days. If they don't do that, it's going to have to be one of these strikes where they very specifically say, you know, 7 months from now, we killed General X because General X planned this strike and we're holding him accountable at a later date, or just never say anything. A missile showed up in his window. I don't know how that happened.
Israel's got about 450,000 max. They mobilize all their reserves. Can they pull off an invasion of Lebanon as they conduct a strike against Iran and they wrap up in Gaza? Do you think they have the capability?
You know, if you'd asked me on October 8th, if Hezbollah had entered on October 8th, I'd have been nervous because I think Israel was on its back heels. You know, they had an existential moment on October 7th. They did not expect, they felt they were secure within their borders. You know, they misunderestimated the ability of Hamas to conduct that strike. But I think in the 6 months since, they've really strengthened their ability to be the military they thought they were, which is fight on a multi-front war. I think they can. I think the biggest problems they have right now is ammunition. Much, you know, like the United States, you know, you have spoken about this before. We allowed our munition levels pre-Ukraine to get down to about 25% of what we needed to fight either China or Russia or, you know, in the Middle East. We had just over time saved money there. Even the Israelis did a little bit of that, and they had less munitions than they would want for a multi-front war. They also had to put a lot of army forces into the West Bank because of the settler violence and the Palestinian terrorism that was going on there. So they were out of position, and they were lower on munitions than they'd want to be. They had been getting a lot of munitions from us, but they've been expending a lot of munitions in Gaza. So I think to be ready for that war, really, to do it right, they need to get, you know, air-to-ground weapons that they're called JDAM, but what they are is a weapon that goes from the air to the ground of either 250, 500, or 1,000 pounds. They need tank rounds, 120-millimeter tank rounds, and they need howitzer rounds, artillery, you know, 155-millimeter rounds. So we need to be pressing that to them. So what's the most important thing? The national security supplemental that is, you know, that Speaker Johnson is looking to roll out, I think, is four parts tonight, as early as tomorrow night, I think. And that's going to be critical. That $14.5 billion in there for Israel is about foreign military grants, FMF, for Israel to get munitions, maybe some presidential drawdown authority to pull munitions quickly from us, as opposed to ordering them from a company, which is what FMF does. And it's also got money for buying, you know, for building a Tamir factory. A Tamir is the weapon in the Iron Dome. It's for buying David's Sling, which is an a cruise missile. Defensive shot, and for something called Iron Beam, which is their directed energy weapon. So there's a lot of money in there. Oh, by the way, there's also some money to replenish the U.S. Navy for all the munitions this expended, both in the Red Sea and in the defense of Israel on Sunday night.
You give me your general reaction to that attack on Saturday night, the defense that was thrown up, and whether or not in the future it will be adequate to the evolving threat from hypersonics.
Defense in depth is required. You know, you really needed those F-15s, you know, flying in over Iraq and Syria, you know, thinning the herd. So then you met, then after those U.S. F-15s had done that aircraft, then the Israeli aircraft came in and no drones got to Israeli airspace. You know, that's phenomenal out of 170 drones. The second thing it did is it reminded us that, you know, Russia, China, Iran, you know, all our adversaries really rely on cruise and ballistic missiles. So we better procure that defense in depth for ourselves, and our allies and partners need to be doing the same thing.
Coming up.
They're funneling money to companies that it knows are engaging in criminal acts in order to kill Americans.
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Charlie Kirk here. It is critical we keep AM radio in all cars and all trucks. More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for news, weather, and opinions. AM is also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping you advised of threatening weather conditions and amber alerts. Text AM to number 52886. Tell Congress that we need AM radio in our cars. Again, text AM to the number 52886. 1-800-686-8686. Standard message and data rates may apply.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. We can only hope that the escalating tensions we see in the Middle East will awaken Americans to the very dangerous world we're living in today. If we were to create a threat pyramid illustrating the principal threats on the world stage today, there's no question China is at the very top. We'll close with outgoing chair of the China Select Committee in the House, Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher, a regular on my program. Chairman Gallagher, for all your time in Congress, and especially as chairman of the Select Committee on Engagement with the Chinese Communist Party, you've been trying to push forward clarity on cyber capability, on TikTok, on China. And the world should know now that China is the head of the snake. Russia and Iran are below that. Below that are Cuba and Venezuela and a few other regimes like North Korea. And below that are these proxy terrorist groups. Do you think you have achieved clarity within the caucus and greater? Do they understand it's two worlds, the West and the anti-West? And the anti-West is led by the Chinese Communist Party. Do you agree with that? And do you think you've got other people clear on that now?
Well, certainly I agree with your framing. I've sort of called it an axis of authoritarian powers. China is the dominant player. Russia is the junior partner. But you also have Iran and North Korea in this axis of authoritarian powers. I believe we have achieved clarity on the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party, but we still have persistent disagreements about what to do about it. But I was struck at the hearing we had yesterday with Attorney General Barr. I mean, look at what our findings revealed. The CCP directly subsidizes the mass production and export of fentanyl and precursors that are illegal to produce in China. They're funneling money to companies that are, it knows are engaging in criminal acts in order to kill Americans. The government owns and rewards companies who openly flout their own law and produce and sell illegal drugs that are killing Americans. So we have a form of chemical warfare underway that's killing tens of thousands of Americans every year. And you know how many Chinese died from fentanyl last year while 70,000 Americans did?
No.
Zero. Zero. That reveals something fundamental about the nature of the regime. And I'm struck by the Democratic rhetoric during the hearing, which suggests we are getting to a level of clarity on the primary enemy we face in Beijing.
Chairman Gallagher, will you continue generally working on the China problem? Because there are very few people with your credibility on it.
Yes, it remains my life's work. Obviously, I'm at a point now where I have to step back from politics and want to prioritize my family. But my passion and my mission will remain the defense of America against the Chinese Communist Party. I've committed myself to the mission of deterring World War III. I know that sounds grandiose, but that is my passion. That's my life's work. And though my job title may change, and I never was one who wanted to stay in Congress for a long period of time, I don't believe that's what Congress should be. It shouldn't be a career. I'll find a different way to attack that same problem from the private sector and hopefully have more time to spend with my wife and my two daughters and grow our family as well.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoyed the program and the podcast, do us a favor and share it with a friend. Let me point out, you can get this podcast, Town Hall Review, as well. Speaker Mike Johnson and This Week on the Hill, and of course my own podcast, all at the Salem Podcast Network. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers David Pouchon, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, and Dwayne Patterson. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.